There's a new ballot initiative in California calling to end the winner-take-all system for distributing the state's electoral votes in a presidential election. If passed, it could alter the outcome of the 2008 race. Republican strategists who are pushing the measure hope to boost the chances of Republican White House candidates in 2008 and beyond by mandating that California's jackpot of 55 electoral votes be apportioned by congressional district. With the state having more than 10% of the 538 national total votes, the GOP would be buoyed by some 20 congressional districts that consistently vote Republican. Enacting such a change would be a blow to Democrats in left-leaning California, who count on the state's large pool of electoral votes in any scenario to win the presidency. As the Christian Science Monitor explains today, President Bush lost California by 1.2 million votes in 2004, although he carried 22 of 53 congressional districts. So, if the districts he won had been equal to 22 electoral votes, then Mr. Bush would not have needed to win the crucial state of Ohio and could have spent time and resources elsewhere. But analysts over at the Center for Voting and Democracy say this is basically fuzzy math. And they're arguing that 436 mini-elections for president would actually be worse than one. We're joined now by Ryan O'Donnell, who was the lead organizer for the National Popular Vote Bill in the Maryland Assembly. Maryland became the first state in the country to sign on to the plan to change the way we elect the president. They did that in April 2007. Ryan runs the Presidential Reform Program for Fair Vote, which is a nonprofit election reform group just outside Washington, D.C., which is where he joins us from. Good afternoon, Mr. Ryan O'Donnell.
Doing?
Oh, very well, thank you. Okay. As we were discussing this morning, radio is not exactly the correct medium for arithmetic, but we're going to give it the good old college try,
so
or at least high school.
The PowerPoint presentation is useless.
Utterly useless. Oh. But look, fuzzy math. Let's deal first with this electoral college and how it works. We have 51 presidential elections in this country every 4 years, correct?
That's right.
Right, not one, but 51. Each state votes for president, and then what happens?
Well, when you vote for president, you're actually voting for electors. And the Constitution says that each state has a number of electors equal to the number of people it has in Congress. That's pretty much all it says. The rest is left up to the states. So states do it differently. But in most of them, in 48 states, whatever candidate gets the most votes there, all of the electoral votes go to that slate of electors. Now, then what happens is the electors get together later on and they cast their votes. I think it was conceived as a way for electors to get together and argue and talk to each other about who's the best president. Nowadays, it's pretty much just a mathematical distortion of the national popular vote.
So, in a place like California, for example, with 55 votes, are they one of the 48 who determine how the votes are awarded in that way?
Yep, California is winner-take-all, and there are two states that do it differently. Maine and Nebraska split them by congressional district, and as you said, California is now looking to do it that way.
But you're not altogether enamored of this splitting by congressional district idea either.
Well, no, you can kind of call winner, winner take all to winner steal all, maybe. It's the problem with the current system, this is where we have to start, is what's wrong with doing it the way we do it now.
Mm-hmm.
And what's wrong with it is most states have absolutely no way and no say in who becomes president. You know, it comes down to Ohio and Florida and Pennsylvania and the biggest swing states. Most of the country isn't even polled by presidential elections. So,
and why is that?
Well, it's because their opinion just doesn't matter. You know, the Bush campaign actually admitted that they didn't poll any state outside of about a dozen or so states in 2004 because the vote wasn't close there. And that's where we see campaigns flock to. They flock to the states that are close, the states that could go one way or the other. And, you know, it's not rocket science. That's where I'd invest my money if I run for president, God forbid, I would run.
God forbid.
You know, I would I would spend my money where I thought I could win, and I wouldn't waste it where I was sure I would win, and I wouldn't waste it where I was sure I would lose.
Okay, so that system doesn't work right now. Why is it that we've had this system for so long, even though it is not fair or it doesn't work?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's evolved over time. Like I said, it's the states that make the decision how to do it. It became pretty clear after the political parties arose, you know, and that wasn't something the founding fathers ever anticipated. It became clear that it maximized the power of political parties within a state if everyone was acting by themselves to do it this way. So by about 1830, most states were using winner-take-all, but some states didn't have elections at all. You know, the legislature would appoint electors, and in other states they had special districts and did it proportionally in all these different ways. So, you know, that is something that has changed over time. And now there's kind of a sense that states have this power, why don't we tinker with our laws to make things fairer? And it's a tricky issue because if you're not careful, you can wind up with something that makes it even less fair, like the California proposal would do. And the reason it would make it less fair in California is because, you know, if you don't like swing states, you're really going to love swing districts. Mm-hmm. There's not a heck of a lot of many districts that are actually competitive in this country. I mean, Congress has returned 99% of its incumbents cycle after cycle to Washington, so there's not much change that happens. Districts are pretty locked up one way or the other. So the election is going to come down to not just a few states, but a few districts, and even less of the country is going to have a say.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your analysis titled Fuzzy Math, I'd like you to take us through some of these figures. In 2000, Al Gore won the popular vote by a small margin but lost the Electoral College vote. Now, Gore's margin of victory in the popular vote was 0.52%, but Bush's Electoral College margin of victory was 0.93%. You argue that if they were to have in place this district by district, congressional district system there, it would actually have magnified the extent of Bush's electoral vote margin of victory. Explain how so.
Well, it's just because of where people live. You know, it's due almost entirely to the fact that the Democratic vote is pretty concentrated in geographic areas where the Democrats are in the majority. You know, in cities and places like this. There's just a geographical, structural boost to the Republican Party. Now, the issue is, it's not reflecting the popular vote. You know, it reflects the popular vote even worse than the Electoral College does. Because we're, like you said, we're originally talking about 51 separate elections. Now we're talking about, you know, 336 separate elections. So it's actually going to exaggerate one party's vote over another relative to the national popular vote. And like I say, it's just because so few districts are actually competitive. And even worse than that is the fact that, you know, states are going to lose out because candidates, you know, whereas before, if they worked hard in Ohio, they may get all 20 of those electoral votes. Now, if they work hard, they may get one or two, you know, just because there are so few votes that could actually go to the Democrats or the Republicans.
We're talking with Ryan O'Donnell, who runs the Presidential Reform Program for Fair Vote, a nonprofit reform group just outside of Washington, D.C. And Mr. O'Donnell was the lead organizer for the National Popular Vote Bill in the Maryland Assembly. Maryland became the first state in the country to sign on to the plan to change the way we elect the president. They did that in April of 2007. Tell us about that story.
Well, you know, this was kind of seen in a lot of quarters, I think, as something that wasn't realistic. Now, the national popular vote has been something that the vast majority of people have backed for a long time, you know, ever since the Gallup organization started polling the question, how should we elect the president? 70-80% of people said, well, we should elect the president the way we elect every other office, from governor to dog catcher. And that's the most votes wins, with every vote equal. But, you know, there's still a sense of this is an impossible task. We're talking about electing the president, you know, for God's sakes. Why are you here in Maryland working on this issue? But as we did, and we told people about how, you know, it is the states that make this decision, and there is a way to do it and get to a national popular vote by working in the states, people really turned on to it pretty quickly. We were fortunate enough to have Senator Birch Bayh from Indiana, who, you know, in the 60s and 70s was a great advocate of a national popular vote. He happened to live in Maryland, and he came to the assembly and talked to people. And in the end, it was one of the most popular and you know, fascinating bills that the assembly debated.
Mm-hmm.
And it ultimately was successful because it's the kind of thing that has such force behind it. It's the force of the merit of being popular, first of all. But it also has just, you know, the force of logic. You know, why shouldn't we elect the president, you know, with the most votes winning and every vote counting the same? And we so revere the idea of one person, one vote in the United States. Why is this not being honored in our most important election? And the answer was, there's no reason. So it eventually won in Maryland.
Now, I think, well, even before I get to the issue of constitutionality, what happens now in Maryland as a result of the fact that Maryland has signed on to this? What if any practical effect does that have?
Yeah, I mean, none right now, because the nature of this compact, the interstate compact that the national popular vote is such that it only goes into effect when you have enough other states doing it too, you know, because it wouldn't make sense for Maryland to do it by itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem with the California measure. If you have all these states acting alone, you know, it's the partisan consequences or, you know, and gamesmanship that are going to come into it are just ludicrous. So nothing happens in Maryland. Maryland's going to do it the same way it always has until we have enough states equaling 270 votes to elect the president with a popular vote.
And why 270 votes?
Oh, sorry, that's a majority in the Electoral College. So right now, it's always the case that candidates have to win a majority. If they don't, it gets thrown to the House of Representatives, where you kind of have even more monkey business go on. And that's actually one of the added benefits to this proposal, is that it would make tying in the Electoral College or a stalemate impossible. And as we go forward in 2008 and think about a possible Bloomberg candidacy and that kind of thing, that monster rears its ugly head again, too.
We're talking with Ryan O'Donnell, who runs the Presidential Reform Program for Fair Vote, and we'll take your questions for him on the Electoral College, figuring out how we elect a president, what works in the current system, what's wrong with the current system, should it be fixed, can it be fixed, and if so, how so, is there at all, is it even conceivable to come up with a system that is fair in a country that is 3,000 miles across with 300 million people in it. We'll take your questions for him at 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. Let's talk a bit, just before we get to these questions, too, about this leapfrogging and the primaries and the caucuses and who gets to have a primary first and so on. How meaningful is that as part of the process?
Well, if you ask the states, it's very meaningful. That's why so many of them are now, you know, leapfrogging over each other to get to the front. And there's a lot of envy of Iowa and New Hampshire, which, as we all know, are the states that have a lot of power in deciding who becomes the nominee. They're the first states to go. And there's a lot of benefit that comes with that, you know, an economic benefit, a political benefit. And just this chance to be courted and influence the race that most of the country just doesn't have. So in 2008, you know, we're going to see probably one of the most chaotic and front-loaded primary calendars ever, just because so many states have rushed forward, and they're calling February 5th, which is a new this new date in the calendar for primaries, they're calling it Tsunami Tuesday.
Tsunami Tuesday.
For that reason, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, if we were to have a direct national election, though, a direct national election for president, what would that do to the primary system?
Well, they're separate. You know, it's the parties can nominate their candidate in their own way, you know, but there's laws that govern that, of course. But It's a separate issue.
Mm-hmm. So there would not necessarily be an implication for the primary system?
No. So the national popular vote is something that deals with the general election and the whole phenomenon of swing states and battleground states. The primary system has, you know, the same theme is involved in a way that so much of the country just isn't having a relevant say, you know, who becomes our nominee or who becomes our president. But no, they don't interact with each other. They're separate.
Okay, let's take some questions for you. Our telephone number, 212-209-2900. Direct presidential elections, how the system works right now, and what, if any, reforms should be pursued at this time in order to make the system more fair, more equitable, and more accessible to the largest number of people, and to make it most reflective of the will of the largest number of Americans. It's 19 after the hour. You are up first with Ryan O'Donnell. Hello. You're on. Hello. Going once? Okay. You're going to have to pay attention here, and please remember to turn your radio down when we get to you. You're on the air. Hello.
Yes, sir. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's okay. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, sir. I'm calling from Brooklyn, and I also did a lot of social studies with the American government system. I didn't know a lot about it, and I'm still at a loss in many aspects about it, but what I was taught was that the idea of the Electoral College was to somehow stop the idea of the mob mentality, where the popularity, the driving popularity of one person, even a cult status of one person, would be stopped by the Electoral College, like your guest said, where they would sit down and maybe debate who would be the best candidate. And the idea that the Electoral College was created just to stop this mob mentality, where somebody would sweep in, mm-hmm. Mesmerize everyone, and just take the country on a specific path, mm-hmm. where they would do what they wish, call referendums and stuff like that to
right.
stop certain actions from taking place. But I'm not quite sure about it. I'm leaving that up to you and your guests. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. O'Donnell. You got that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, my personal opinion is that what you call the mob is pretty much just the people when you disagree with what they think, you know. But it's a concern, and I think when we talk about the Electoral College, we have to recognize that right now, you know, it is nothing like the Senate or the Congress. People don't get together and debate who's the best president. Pretty much to be an elector, you just have to be the best fundraiser. You know, and that's how you get to be an elector. It's kind of an honorary position. So, you know, there is no debate. It is more of a mathematical distortion of the national popular vote. And the question I come up with is, you know, if it's truly something that's important to take into account and protect against, you know, why don't we use the Electoral College for everything? Why don't we have many electoral colleges, you know, for dog catcher, you know, for example? And we don't. I think if we sat down at a table with a blank piece of paper today and said, let's create the best presidential election system we possibly could, we certainly wouldn't come up with this crazy Rube Goldberg kind of invention that the Electoral College is these days. It's just, it wouldn't happen.
Let's take another question. Good afternoon, Talk Back. You are up next with Ryan O'Donnell of Fairvote. Hello. You're on. Hello. Okay, we're going to move on to someone
else.
That's
me, Brent, calling you, by the way.
Okay, good afternoon. Now, here you have a political analyst with a sense of humor, and that's a beautiful thing. So we're going to keep you on for as long as possible, trust
okay.
me. Because you have a sense of humor, and of course, this is something that is rare among people who deal with this particular area of study.
It's like working in the morgue or something.
Good afternoon. You are up next. Hello. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on. Okay, I'm beginning to think that we are having a bit of a technical problem here. So we're going to try to sort that out before we continue. We'll take your questions for Ryan O'Donnell, 212-209-2900. Let's give it another try. You're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask what this would have on advertising and on campaign travel.
Advertising and household, you want to flesh that out a little bit? What do you mean by that?
Well, how with a national election, how that would affect. Right now, I think they advertise heavily in regional markets to swing elections in certain states.
Okay, I see what you mean, Mr. O'Donnell.
Well, so the city of Toledo, Ohio, was probably the worst city for advertising because they just got carpet bombed day and night in 2004 with political ads, and it was so because you didn't just reach Ohio, you also reached other swing states in the region. And that's the effect of running a 51-state campaign, but really a 12-state campaign, you know, restricting your travel and your polling and your advertising to about a dozen states, swing states. Now, if you had a national popular vote, you know, politicians go with their votes, and they advertise with those votes. So suddenly they're going to start paying attention to all 50 states. And, you know, advertising reaches, you know, urban and rural areas at once. So many more people are going to be engaged. And, you know, sometimes I hear the argument that, you know, the last thing we want is more advertising, you know, and that may be true, but what advertising does is a barometer of how much politicians care about you. That's kind of their love note to you is, you know, 30-second spots. Mm-hmm. And so most of the country is not getting any love notes right now, and that would change.
Okay, let's take another one. Good afternoon. You are up next with Ryan O'Donnell. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm wondering, if they want the people to vote, why do they have the college? It's like if the college don't like what the people say, they make their own choices. And nowadays, I noticed that the more money you have is when you could be president or you have, you know, if you know somebody in the government. So I'll hang up and hear your answer.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Well, you know, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, there one right we don't have. We have a right to free speech. We have a right to bear arms. We do not have a right to vote for anything but Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And at the federal level. And so we don't have a right to vote for president. And like I say, it used to be that state legislatures from time to time would choose the electors, and the people wouldn't. You know, one year in Massachusetts, when they were afraid that Thomas Jefferson was going to do pretty well, and Massachusetts was controlled by allies of John Adams, they said, well, let's just not have an election this year. And so the Federalists in Massachusetts appointed electors for the people. And that was cute. So, you know, that kind of thing is probably unthinkable these days. But
why?
Well, I mean, it would be, I mean, kind of nuts. I mean, for a legislature, any legislature that did not certify the popular vote and acted on their own, I think would face dire consequences from the voters the next year.
Well, some people might argue that what happened in 2000 was only marginally removed from the kind of scenario that you're talking about, a unilateral action taken by one of the arms of government.
In fact, the Supreme Court decision, you know, Bush versus Gore, said, you know, pretty much just that, that at any time, had the legislature decided to do so, they could have said, well, recounts or no recount, we're just going to solve this and allocate our votes to whoever the legislature wanted to.
What about the role of faithless electors? How does that factor into this equation?
Yeah, faithless electors are people who are chosen to vote for one candidate, but then they change their mind. And it sounds like a scary thing, but they're not very common. There was one in 2004, I think, in Minnesota, who voted for Edwards. So John Edwards actually got one electoral vote in 2004. So he came in third, I guess you could say. But the thing of it is, most of the time, it's just people are making a mistake, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And however, that is a concern, and that's one of the things a national popular vote would eliminate.
Do you think there is ever going to be a national popular vote, say, in the next, 20 years? Do you think more people, that enough states will follow Maryland's lead on this?
I do. I mean, you know, look at all the reforms that have gone through over history. You know, we never used to have a right to vote for senators. Women used to not be able to vote. Both those movements began at the state level, not the federal level. Now we have a movement to get a fair presidential election system that's begun at the state level in Maryland, and states are going to do this, I think we could see it by 2012, potentially.
Potentially by 2012. That is very soon. Okay.
I'll come back on if I'm wrong if I'm right.
I will certainly hold you to that.
Okay.
It's 28 minutes after the hour. Can I ask you to hold on for another 12 minutes or so? I've got other people here who would like to ask questions of you, and we're up against a hard break. Can I prevail upon you to
that's very nice
tarry for a while longer? Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. This is WBAI New York. When we return, more on a direct vote for president in this country, dealing with the electoral college, and basically ways of strengthening the democratic process at the level of the presidential elections. We'll take your questions for Ryan O'Donnell at 212-209-2900. Stay with us. Third of minutes after the hour, and we're talking with Ryan O'Donnell, who runs the Presidential Reform Program for Fair Vote, a nonprofit election reform group just outside of Washington, D.C. Mr. O'Donnell's commentaries on politics have been published in numerous newspapers and journals, including the Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun, the Boston Globe, Miami Herald, San Jose Mercury News, Seattle Post, Intelligencer, and TomPaine.com, and right here in the Newark Star-Ledger, right next door and within our listening area. And he was a research fellow for the Electoral Reform Society in Britain during their general election in 2005. Our number is 212-209-2900. We'll get to more of your questions for him. Mr. O'Donnell, it just occurred to me listening to the public service announcement, to the announcement during the break, that this issue of instant runoff voting is also one that has attracted quite a bit of interest in some situations. Is that a model that works at the presidential level?
I think a lot of people got interested in it because of the 2000 election, when they felt they may have voted for someone who acted as a spoiler. And instant runoff voting removes that concern because you rank your candidates, and if you vote for someone who can't win, then your second choices come into play. So, yeah, certainly, you know, whenever you have more than two candidates running for something, in most elections in the United States, things tend to break down. So that certainly applies to presidential races, for both parties, I should say.
Okay, let's take some more questions for you. Good afternoon, Talk Back. You are up next with Ryan O'Donnell. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Yes, I don't know if you answered this question, but I want to know, when was the Electoral College introduced into the Constitution, or was it written in when they were drafting it? And I think the Maryland thing you were saying, is that the first attempt at repealing the electoral vote? I'll listen up. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Mr. O'Donnell.
Well, the Electoral College was written in the Constitution. It was amended pretty quickly, after it was written down, because we had a strange election where you had kind of a tie, and then you couldn't deal with the vice president and president, because you used to vote for president and vice president separately, and now we vote for them on a ticket, of course. So that had to be amended around 1800. So it's been changed, you know, and it's been changed to allow people under 21 to vote, you know, for president, and it's been changed to allow citizens of the District of Columbia to vote for president. So it's been amended, you know, around the edges several times. And what was the second part of this?
Okay, the second one, I think he wanted wanted you to talk a bit more about the significance of the Maryland initiative. He described it as an effort to abolish Electoral College.
Well, right, you know, it's actually, we're not abolishing the Electoral College. We're using state law, because the one thing that the Constitution doesn't say about the Electoral College is what states can do to award their electors. And the answer is they can do whatever they want. Our bill simply says, let's give them to the winner of the national popular vote. Right now, the Electoral College rubber stamps. I mean, the Electoral College is a rubber stamp. You know, these people are not getting together and deliberating. So right now, it rubber stamps the state vote and our bill makes it rubber stamp the national popular vote.
Now, how many electoral votes are there in the state of Maryland? How many electors?
Ten.
Okay. Now, suppose one candidate got 40% of the vote and one candidate got 60% of the vote. Would it not be fairer to apportion the 10 votes, four and six, rather than giving everything to the person who won?
Well, the thing about that is, you know, what if they win 55% versus 45? One of the people in Maryland who was influential in getting this passed was Senator Roy Dyson. And Senator Dyson had been an elector himself in the past. And as it turned out, so had his mother. If you had asked Senator Dyson to cut his mother in half in order to accommodate, 0.5% of the vote, he might have objected. So there are certain mathematical problems with doing that, just because, you can't divide people. But the main issue is that if you do it one state at a time, it does two things. One, it has partisan consequences. In fact, it's foolish for Maryland to do it by itself because it takes away its power. In Maryland, it would help the Republican Party. If you did it in Utah, it would help the Democratic Party. So partisan gamesmanship comes in. Now, if you do it by congressional district, you get a whole other can of worms. Suddenly gerrymandering rears its head, and gerrymandering can not only screw up your congressional districts for Congress, it can start screwing with the presidency, too. And finally, it's just, it's no guarantee of reflecting the national popular vote, and every vote still doesn't count the same. And I think we ought to honor the principle of one person, one vote.
So what essentially you've adopted is a winner take all system, but it reflects the person who wins the majority of the vote in the state.
Right, and that's the way we do it now, too, with the winner-take-all.
Okay. Let's take another question. Good afternoon, TalkBack. You are up next with Ryan O'Donnell of FairVote. Hello. You're on.
Hello.
Yes, you're on.
Yeah, the stuff about the electoral. Back in the 50s, I remember there was a big debate about it, because it always goes on. There was a speech in Congress by a senator, and he pointed out that if you wanted a popular vote, you would dilute the power of minorities who were concentrated in a lot of the big states and the big cities. Where now they're the swing votes, a lot of them, and they're catered to, and people go after their vote. Where if you had a nationwide vote, the minority vote would be diluted to a point where they wouldn't have the political influence they have now. And that senator was John F. Kennedy. And I remember reading that 45 years ago, and I think it still holds true today. So you really have to watch, if you move this, how it's going to affect a lot of minority voters.
Okay, it's an excellent point, Mr. O'Donnell. How does that work?
Well, swing states change over time, and if you look at, if you consider the swing state to be the only important unit in a presidential election, which it is, then you start thinking, all right, who lives in these swing states? Now, the majority of African Americans do not. Think of all the states in the South, where there are lots of African Americans, for example, that always go Republican. Think of all the Latinos in New York and California whose state is a foregone conclusion. Now, those are big states with large minority populations, but their voice doesn't matter at all in presidential elections, and candidates know that. If they did matter, we'd start seeing different policies in the United States, I think.
Okay, let's take one other question here for you. 38 minutes after the hour, you are up next with Ryan O'Donnell of FairVote. Hello, you are on the air. Hello, you're on. Going once? Okay. Gone, not there. At 39 minutes after the hour, here's what we'll do. We're going to wrap this up now, do a 10-minute open phone segment. But what's the next move on this? Which states, Mr. O'Donnell, are likely to follow the lead of Maryland. I see here that the Christian Science Monitor is reporting today that voter frustration with the Electoral College system in the past two presidential elections has spurred several states, including Colorado, North Carolina, Texas, and Florida, to consider changing the current system. But they're thinking about changing their system to the one that is being suggested in California. Which states are likely to follow Maryland's lead?
Well, I think we could still see victories in Illinois, New Jersey this year, and then next year it's a whole new ball game, because once you actually start getting enactments, it becomes obvious that this is a politically feasible plan, and we're going to start seeing a whole bunch of other states do this. Right now there's bills in 47, and nationwide there's about 350 legislative sponsors, so it's a big deal. And I don't know where exactly, but we're going to see some movement.
Ryan O'Donnell runs the Presidential Reform Program at FairVote, a nonprofit election reform group just outside of Washington, D.C. Their analysis, titled Fuzzy Math, of the proposal in California to have the election, the Electoral College vote divided up as though it were a portion according to congressional districts. Well, it's described in an op-ed piece that was published on August 9th by the Center for Voting and Democracy, which is also a Fair Vote, as fuzzy math. And we've been talking with Ryan O'Donnell about why that is so. You can find out more about the work that they're doing at www.fairvote.org. That's FAIRVOTE.org. Mr. O'Donnell, thank you very much for shedding light on this otherwise arcane issue.
It was my great pleasure. Thank you.